counterculture. It's one illustration of a whole slew of books that are dealing with problems of American culture, and it's one that's fairly pessimistic. And I guess I chose it really because he fits in with my view, not only in terms of his pessimism, but in terms of the way he looks at the nature of the problem. Broadly speaking, there are several ways of looking at the problem. You can locate the problem of American culture kind of in the person, and you need to deal with the person. You can locate it kind of in the social system. If you could just change the social system, that's kind of a Marxist position, everything else would follow. Or you can locate it in the culture, in the values. And that's where Rozek locates it, and that's where I locate it. So this is a matter of changing political institutions. It's not a matter of getting justice. It's a matter of the content of justice. To get justice in our society, if you used equality or freedom of initiation as principles, and it wouldn't change the situation from Rozek's point of view measurably. It'd be good, but it wouldn't tackle a fundamental problem. The problem in our culture really is our worldview, and the worldview that we are suffering under is the worldview of science. And so today I'm going to summarize by giving you an autopsy of science according to Rozek, which is a summary really of the first seven chapters. And the problem is that science has a way of apprehending or looking at reality which is very limited. What Rozek calls single vision, taking that word out of William Blake, poet, artist. And the single vision, which means really looking at things chiefly with the organ that's located between the ears and behind the eyes, and not with any of the other senses, and a very curtailed way, Rozek said, of looking at things. And that single vision results in a very flattened out view of reality. Reality is what you can catch in a certain kind of a net, the net being the instruments that science uses. Now, the result then is that we have big science, he says, and the undoing of the human scale. The unresolved problems in controlling nature and human beings are of such a nature that they require intensive specialization, more teamwork, more sophisticated equipment. So as time goes on, there must be more scientists, more money, more coordination of research, more administration, more superstructure, and altogether more political maneuvering within the scientific community, as well as between science and society. Science has become big business, and science joins then in the ethos of impersonal giganticism. We no longer find there a community of self-actualizing men and women pursuing their chosen calling with style, daring, and simple passion. Such individuals may, of course, be there, but they are lost from sight within an establishment of baroque complexity, a labyrinth of official hierarchies and elite conferences, of bureaus and agencies filled with rich careers and Mandarin status. It blows my mind to think of what increasing resources may be necessary to get new knowledge and to communicate it. If our own drives did not push us to a kind of unlimited extension of our knowledge factories, competition with the rest of the world does, and increasingly will. There's just no limit to the amount of money we can spend on research. If we want to keep up with Russia. Second, earth rape, the undoing of progress. Without any sense of our intimate relations and interdependencies with nature, we have created an artificial environment which ignores nature, except to use it and to make unlimited demands upon it. Until the results of this rape became visible as threats to human existence, no significant voice was raised against such use of nature. Now it is a constant battle between the forces of progress, science, and technology, and the ecologists. Our whole view of progress is measured by scientific and technological development. Our whole view, which is measured, is now threatened by the ecological results. What we have been about, the source of the meaning of our civilization, and now is now in doubt. He says, we may yet take our place in folk memory as the age of the great sacrilege, which was smitten from on high for its wanton ways. What happens is we learn that the scientific worldview does not work. A worldview which creates the desire for unlimited knowledge and unlimited productivity and unlimited use of natural resources. It looks as if the future is not destined to be an endless escalator of improvement. What will we do for the meaning of our existence? Science, Rosak contends, is of little use in helping us understand why nature is revolting and what the revolt means. American Indian lore, Zen, and Tantra seem to be our only resources for understanding our predicament. Technocracy, the undoing of the open society. The solution of problems by rational discussion has been associated with science, since it is the same reason that seeks to find solutions, both within scientific and political realms. That is the same reason it seeks in both realms. This identification of science with the open rational society is now questionable, however. Science increasingly is seen to be capable of serving instrumentally the interests of an open or a closed society. In Hitler's Nazi Germany, scientists made a poorer show of resistance than Jehovah's Witnesses. They made the best, I think. It may be a poor example. But the German scientific community acquiesced almost to a man. The present protests of young scientists in America, Japan, and Europe that productive research has no necessary relationship to social health and freedom indicates an awareness within the scientific community of its plight, in spite of the fact that Rosak feels that significant protest is unlikely to come from those who are so well provided for materially by technocracy. Partly what they rebel against is stated by Dr. James Shapiro and his colleagues after creating the first naked gene at Harvard in 1969, quote Dr. Shapiro. I guess it was a statement by all of them. The basic control over scientific work and its development is in the hands of a few people at the head of large private institutions and at the top of government bureaucracy. These people have consistently exploited science for harmful purposes in order to increase their own power. The real issue here seems to be that science is really not producing, via the way it is functioning, any model for our open society where decisions are made by rational discussion. Fourth, quantifiable man, the undoing of the political community. Quantifiable man is man who can be understood by science, man whose laws of behavior can be known and applied. Skinner is a perfect illustration. Divorced both from the passions and interests of persons and from a consideration of ends or goals, politics becomes administration. Politics becomes a matter of knowledge and of application of laws of behavior, rather than an art in which opinion, passions, and differences in values have to be taken into account. The uninvolvement of observer and observed in science is far different from the kind of identification and expansion of the self required for peace and community. Without compassion, sacrifice, and magnanimity, politics disintegrates, and the murdering furies of the political arena reign. Politics is much more than a matter of fact and logic. When it is considered to be such, it becomes the fact and logic of some elite. The reductionist assault, the undoing of the mysteries. The initial effect of the scientific revolution to vastly enhance the stature of man and magnificence of nature. And the love or the tone of exuberant celebration has been offset by the compulsive need to disenchant whatever was mysterious, immaterial, transcendent, to reduce all things to the terms that objective consciousness might master. We talked about this yesterday. Reductionism has been with us since Galileo boldly read the human observer out of nature. by concluding that the primary qualities of reality, real reality, are its objective measurables, and so nothing more, nothing personal and ethically intuitive, need enter into our examination of nature. The behavioral approach to psychology and sociology represents the culmination of the reductionist tendency, where the living reality of the person in society is replaced by so many one-dimensional statistical counterfeits. Accompanying the reduction of the mystery of the world is the reduction of persons to guinea pigs for the sake of knowledge, for its own sake. The movement in this direction begins with the reduction of animals to things, and the belief that the inclusion of lower animals in our ethical system is philosophically meaningless and operationally impossible, to quote one scientist. Science, which promises control over our behavior, can be expected to produce a reaction from persons who feel that prediction and control imply the thingification of persons and will be resisted. Some will come to the point where they resist, where they might will unpredictability, chaos, against the over-systematized social randomness, order, against the technocratic manipulations. In other words, people will simply will chaos because they don't want to be caught in this scientific controlled net. Of course, there's much science which is free from any reductionist intention. But reductionism, the turning of people and nature into mere worthless things, is also part of science. It is born from the act of objectification. It is implied by the assumption that knowledge must be the power to predict and control. It is embedded in the unfortunate notion that knowledge is to be sought for its own sake, as a thing apart from compassion, humanity, wisdom, and beauty. He doesn't think there's any hope in the present scientific community for changing that. And then finally, what he calls esotericism, the undoing of shared culture. The progressive and cumulative science, assuming that all good liberal values can be automatically guaranteed by the headlong advance of science and technology, has moved beyond the comprehension of even extraordinary citizens, creating an intellectual vacuum regarding its moral and metaphysical meanings, and produced a kind of collage of specialized bodies of knowledge, reduced the world about which ordinary people can know to zero. Yet, he says, the imaginative energies to which we owe so much of the world's myth and folklore remain within us, and we want to express them, and life becomes gray indeed if they cannot be exercised, and so we're going to exercise them. Says, thus, Dante's Divine Comedy may provide us with wisdom, metaphysical insight, and visionary power in spite of its false cosmology. And Rozek believes that we have in science nothing that's really going to help us live in our present world in terms of ultimate understandings and ultimate values, and that the whole worldview of science is a worldview which denies status to values, status in the world. Values become subjective, and we can't go on indefinitely with this kind of a worldview which denies us a significant place in the world, which tries to reduce all of our existences to organic and inorganic reality and laws. And he feels that participation in that which is meaningfully, experientially, if not intellectually understood, is essential to man's being. And the turn to mystical religion, primitive lore and ritual, occultism, disciplines of meditation, all represent an attempt to fill the vacuum. And I suppose some people would say that Jonathan Livingston Seagull is the real response to a vacuum. And he feels that this kind of protest will continue until our present order is really undermined, and we then may be ready, he says, for a post-industrial society. And then I want to talk a little about the nature of that post-industrial society, which summarizes the last five chapters of the book, and it's a little task to summarize it, but he turns to the romantic artists to see a descent from this single vision and to attempt to begin a rediscovery of the meaning of the transcendent. See, one of his real contentions is that we have just eliminated by our scientific method whole dimensions of reality. Dimensions of reality which are apprehended by means other than those that are used in science. So that just give you a few illustrations of what he's calling upon. This is from Blake. Unless the eye catch fire, the God will not be seen. Unless the ear catch fire, the God will not be heard. Unless the tongue catch fire, the God will not be named. Unless the heart catch fire, the God will not be loved. Unless the mind catch fire, the God will not be known. Now there's a sense in which he's put one, two, three, four things before the mind. And it's those, it's kind of, it isn't that the mind isn't involved, but it's that the mind becomes everything. And that which can be understood in such a way that can be systematized, caught in the networks of logical categories. Wordsworth. I held unconscious intercourse with beauty, old as creation, drinking in a pure organic pleasure from the silver wreaths of curling mist, or from the level plain of waters colored by impending clouds. To every natural form, rock, fruit, or flower, even the loose stones that cover the highway, I gave a moral life. I saw them feel, or linked them to some feeling. The great mass lay bedded in a quickening soul, and all that I beheld respired with inward meaning. And then Goethe. Mystery filled in the light of day, nature won't have her veil stripped away, hide or show. It's hers to choose. She'll not be forced with rack or screws. An interesting interpretation of these three poets as representing two, three, four levels of vision as over against a single vision. One of his illustrations is the difference between a map and a landscape. And he's contending that science is like cartography, that's making a map of reality. And he's contending that even if you have a map of this area, those who are native, he used the word native to the area, know things and experience things and have a reality present to them that no map can portray. And what science has done in its equation and in its systematization is to give us a map of reality, which is like a map, an abstraction. And the question is how we then deal with the reality. He feels that one of the things that's interesting about Castaneda, and I think he says he wrote this chapter before he came across what Castaneda had said, but that the kind of experiences that Carlos Castaneda had in dealing with Don Juan indicate the issue as to what is real. And he says, not a simple matter to determine what is real. And how much of what Don Carlos experienced is real? Which world is real? saying that this kind of an experience that Castaneda is writing about illustrates the problem, the epistemological problem, the problem of what it is that we call real, and the problem that Castaneda has. I've only read the first book and Sarah's quicker than the last two, but the problem that he has in knowing what is real is a real issue. Now what Rozak is calling for is what he calls a rhapsodic intellect. And what Tillich would call this, I think, is reason in ecstasy, but a reason which transcends the kind of limited view that Rozak and Tillich would assign to technical reason. Tillich's discussion is very interesting, for in the 18th century, reason functioned, for example, in Kant, to determine the ends of life. Reason was able to deal with values, with ends, with purposes. As reason developed in the 19th century, it became technical and dealt only with means. And the great plea is not to deny reason, but to broaden its meaning and its functioning so that it's an integrated into what Tillich would call an ecstatic reason, which is reason which stands out from itself, which is informed by the whole of one's being, and therefore deals with levels of reality. Tillich's multidimensional notion of man in terms of organic, inorganic, organic, psychological, and spiritual, I think, points to the same kind of thing, that what science has done is reduce man largely to his inorganic and organic. And there are statements in here in which Rozak is showing how the scientists attempt to get everything explained by virtue of the physical or natural being. Well, the results of this, of course, are that we have an artificial environment created by our productive enterprise. We believe that we can save souls by secular progress, that the way in which we find meaning is in terms of productivity, and Rozak thinks we ought to reverse the artificiality of our environment and de-urbanize. He really thinks that the cities are places that are not viable. That's my term. He would say where people don't want to be. And my own conclusion is that they're not viable. There's no way to make the big cities humanly habitable. No way, I know. And you can't keep law and order, and you can't simply use force. And the force that is used is the force of those in power to keep law and order, and not a good deal of the time not to do justice, in my experience, in black community. And whether or not we agree with that, there's simply no way to rehabilitate the cities that I know of. So he's suggesting that we de-urbanize and find a way of organizing life without concentration of people in the cities.
Excuse me, is a city a result then of the scientific thing?
That's what he would say it is. It's a result of our desire for unlimited productivity, and the productivity concentrating around the sources of money and services that are in the big cities, and that there's no need to do that, and we might lose some productivity if we moved out, and yet we can't afford really the cost in human resources. And he doesn't have a formula. He says there's no formula, no blueprints for this, but we simply have to begin to get disenchanted, really, with what is taking place And then the second thing he wants is an economy of permanence in which work is done in community, again resulting in some reduction, perhaps, of productivity. But he calls for low consumption, high quality alternatives, which means, of course, that we have to experiment with communities in which there's low consumption and in which all kinds of different lifestyles are attempted. I don't know how you do that. There are communities all over, as we know. And he gets letters all the time since he wrote The Making of the Counterculture. But he says most of them will probably fail. I mean, he has no illusion about them. But he says, nevertheless, they're the only hope. And he encourages all of them because they're the beginnings of efforts to find meanings that do not buy into either the way of looking at life that science has given us or the productive enterprise that is followed from us as the only source of meaning. And I really think that his fundamental conviction is that we don't have any other way of being. We've desacralized nature. We don't find meaning somehow in our being apart from our participation in the productive enterprise. And until we somehow find meaning. Now, many of the Eastern religions find meaning in a kind of repetition of what they would call paradigmatic or forms of action which they associate with some primordial forming process or some primordial process, and it's kind of a repetition of that. So if you go through similar processes, there's a kind of meaning in either in ritual or in terms of course they tend to ritualize all kinds of things, whether it's work or play or what we'd call worship. But however it be, what our historians of religion are calling the religious has been, you know, kind of wiped out of our existence. And there is very little meaning, and I feel it's very little meaning apart from one's contribution to some ongoing system of production. And with me, it's production of students or of books or articles, I don't write books, or something. It isn't the production isn't necessary, but he says it's got to be a backup. It's got to be secondary to something else. So our whole productive enterprise and the science which has fostered it and the worldview of science which has permitted it got to be placed subordinate to something. Now, I think we would all say that's subordinate to our faith. The question is, as I've said frequently, how do we subordinate that to our faith unless our faith says something about all of these things? Unless it places everything in perspective, unless it provides us with a source of meaning which deals with these things.
I have a question. Is what has happened to the religious in that it has been explained in the concept of this reality, this scientific concept of reality, is limiting reality causing the problem,
yeah,
as far as the religious is concerned, and is part of the thing. It would seem to me that's why Castaneda is so appealing, because he's expanding our concept.
That's right. He feels very strongly, the Protestant religion particularly, I found out today he's a Catholic, the Protestant religion, but I would say the same thing. The Protestant religion, by virtue of its insistence upon the communication by word alone, that's particularly true of Calvinism, and some true of Lutheranism, and its attack on the idolatry sensuous things. I mean, if you take the Catholic churches over against ours, I suppose he's used to it, with all the art and incense and all kinds of media that are used, cult of the Virgin and things that appeal to something other than the head. And where we have tried, now I think Holden is a little different. You get a kind of a celebration here that's going on all the time that appeals to all kinds of dimensions of your being. I don't think we have too much of an interpretation of nature here, we ought to have a theology of nature. We have no theology of nature. We have no theology of art in Protestantism, of the aesthetic. I mean, we've really not dealt with those dimensions. That's what he says, and that's what I think. I mean, I use his position. I would say when I disagree with it, generally I agree with it. That's his interpretation. I think it's true that we have depended upon the word to communicate the faith. As I said yesterday, our studies of people's cognitive knowledge shows they have such little cognitive knowledge that if the word in truth is creating the faith, we're in sad trouble because people don't know anything about the Bible, or that we tried it with just parables and they didn't know the content of the parable. So unless the music and the ritual and the architecture, Tillich used to say, I'd rather take my son into a cathedral than into a lot of religious education, all the religious education, because of the dimensions involved, the communication process. And it's clear in here that he said, when you learn the catechism, for example, what do you learn? What's happening to you in the communication of those words? That's his position at any rate.
You can't communicate all.
And I tend to agree that, and I think that's why a lot of people have been moving in another direction. The same thing in terms of the whole educational system. The educational system is seen primarily, except where John Dewey came in, and to the extent in which he stayed in, focused on experiences over against ideas, learning mathematics or words is over against having broad experience. Well, Dewey, and I just finished reading Dewey's Experience in Nature, really comes down hard on the side of experience and broad experience. Dewey also comes down hard on the side that whatever you experience is in nature. And that's so different from our science, you see, because if you experience beauty, then somehow that beauty is not just subjective for Dewey. But if you don't experience it, you don't have it. I mean, and his position, and I think Rozak is saying it, that we have so cognitized our approach to reality that all the rest of us is left out. And so in the section which he's talking about repression of the body and sexuality is that the whole body is repressed. And it's in that context that we have to think of it. All the means of communication except the rational powers, and those that are largely controlled by what we can put into formula and measure by the machines we have, are not valid. So poetic imagination, for example, which he emphasizes very highly, is not a means to experience reality. It's largely a subjective experience for us. But he is trying to indicate that it relates us to dimensions of reality. Now, over against the kind of image that we've had of man, because of our limited view of him, and while this has changed somewhat in the modern physics, I think we still tend to have this view in our social sciences. As modern physics, we are all part of all kinds of energy fields and so forth. The little I know about it, I know that it's hard to locate a nice little blob of anything. I mean, you don't know where anything is. I mean, you can, your counters will show some things, and we see some things, but it's very hard to locate. But we come out of a view in which there are kind of isolated particles. I meant to bring that. I did a painting trying to show this. Particles which are related externally, competing with each other. That's certainly the model we have in our economic system. And that model, he says, is contrary. I think it's contrary to the nature of existence, myself. That is, and certainly it's contrary to our faith. We are declared to be, by our faith, parts of each other. We belong to each other. What happens to one happens to the other. And yet our whole model of society is the opposite. Now, he says Darwin gave us this kind of model of competition. You compete or you die. Kropotkin gave us another model of mutual aid, and we've chosen Darwin. And the result is an isolation of individuals It's very interesting. My colleague and I are writing together now. We're writing together, I'm sure, in part because he's coming out of Heidegger, who says the fundamental principle of being is belonging. And so the notion that he has his career and everything's, you know, you get so you don't want to even want to talk to your colleague because you'll give him an idea and he'll write it and get credit for it. I mean, it's a fact. And but now we're writing together, and he says we'll publish together and so forth. I mean, he apparently has bought into this thing that we talk about as being real, but our society doesn't buy into it. And it's this commutarian view of life and politics that Rozak is saying is wanted by a lot of people. It's desired. And again, there are no blueprints. It's just a matter of beginning in small ways. He's got a whole list of things here which I won't read about the blueprints for all of these things that that might be useful, all kinds of things. But the extended family, for example. When I took care of Paul and Julie's kids the other day, I was doing it out of the notion of the extended family, that I wasn't simply responsible for me or just for me and Sarah, but that we were here a community, and we were, if we were real, we would be responsible for each other. And since we don't have kids, we'd help take care of their kids and actualize our belongingness. And it was funny, I wish Jim Burton's were here, but he told Sarah that three of the most important things he was doing now had nothing to do with his job or anything. They had to do with three groups of people. One, a play reading group, another, a group that just got together for supper and sharing, and I don't know what the other group did. But the community was becoming important for him, instead of all other stuff that's given us our meanings. And well, that's kind of the direction that this moves. Some kind of direction. You can see when I get enthusiastic where I am.
It's true then that people are aware of the lack of meaning. And it seems like there at least is some consciousness that the value that one gets out of competing and doing better than someone else, it has a kind of a shallowness to it. And yet, is there a fear that to take some other new model or try something new is what prevents people from moving in new ways?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's now a discussion. Yeah.
How do you feel about it? You who spoke up.
No.
We didn't mean to put you on the spot, but
she did. But I,
no,
I'm not sure. I think you know, the fear of failing certainly.
I've had a fear of failing all my life.
Yeah.
I think we're failure oriented.
I never will forget the one job I had. And I followed a wham doozer boy. And I never should have taken it, because you know so much of your success depends upon who was there before you in a church or anything else. And I like to start new organizations.
I think that's a real important factor in our culture, is failing and how much we fear failing. And I mean, what's wrong with failing?
People aren't allowed to fail either.
Pardon?
Some people aren't allowed to fail.
They don't allow themselves to fail, or someone else hasn't allowed them to fail. You know, the school and parents. And
well, you've got to be careful you don't want to ruin them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but your question is, what would failure be?
Yeah, whose definition
is
it?
And it seems to me that the problem that Rozak is raising is with our definition of failure, what it is that we consider to be worth doing.
I'm not sure I see the pessimism. If Rozak's analysis is correct, and there are at least he at least sets forth some ideas about what we can do, or if nothing else, we can infer what we need to do from what he sees wrong. Is there any room for optimism?
Well, of course, I don't look at it as kind of optimistic pessimism. I mean, he's pessimistic about where we are, as over against some other people who, for one reason or another, I think, to answer your question, couldn't accept this. I think one of the things I think my consider my role is to get people to experience what they're experiencing. That is to see. We tried this out on a highfalutin group of bourgeois church people in Lake Forest, Presbyterian and Episcopalians, who are the presidents of the corporations and so forth, to see whether they would buy into this kind of thing. And of course, we had a very select group because it's self-selected in terms of who would come to this kind of thing, dealing with race and this issue. And my colleague again and I were working together on this thing. And we got some real acceptance of it. But I think most people feel the present system does not really limit their freedom very much. You know, you have a hard time getting people to agree that the present system of their life really limits them a great deal. And you have to push. This one guy had moved to Chicago because his corporation sent him, and they gave him one day to decide whether he could take the job or not. And he didn't want to go, and he had a lot of community relations and a nice church life in Cleveland, or Pittsburgh, I guess it was. And he didn't want to come, but he came. But you really had to push him to get him to see that that was a part of a whole system, and that the system was what had him caught. Now he was trying to think about another occupation. But how can he think about another occupation with three kids and cars and all the rest of the stuff? But we didn't get a lot of. People can always see other people kind of being bound, but it's very hard to see yourself as being bound and accept it, you know. It's a threat to what you've been, I think. We've all bought into this system. And if what Rozacki says is right, if what I think is right, we are justified by our participation in productivity, in a productive enterprise. And that doesn't say production is all wrong. It only says it's become a kind of demonic thing. And the question is, how then can you limit it? How can you get control of it?
Let me ask you this. Do you think things have ever been basically much different?
Well, I don't know.
Do people have, you know, really any control?
Do you?
Much control? I don't know. I haven't lived forever. All I know is what I've seen, and, you know, I can't. I know that in times past, economic realities were much harsher than they are now, at least for the people in the United States. And I don't think that people have ever had a lot of control over what they did with their lives, except to labor from sunrise to sunset. And
I'm not sure that we don't have less control on bureaucracy and society changing at such a rapid pace, and us having to complete, trying always to adapt to these changes, you know. And that makes me feel like I don't have control, or it makes me feel helpless and makes me feel.
Does anyone think we're in a fundamentally different position economically than we've been before?
I don't know about that, but I know some people that are just, you know, they're taking control of their own lives. They're living pretty simply. They're not rich or living luxuriously, but they're having a really good time living. And I get very uncomfortable when I'm around them because I really feel locked into a program.
The problem is kind of like poverty in times of inflation. Prices going up and expanding and everything, and yet you have depression for a large part of the population. And a lot of people have money, and we all come up here, and I'm not saying coal costs too much, please. I'm saying we all have the ability to come up here. And yet we're all locked into something. And the guy who worked from sundown to sunset, then we went to the next town. I mean, the situation is different. But the possibilities are that are different. It may be hard to say, it would be for me. But somehow things seem...
We certainly enjoy a greater economic freedom across the board of the total gross national productivity. is greater freedom? At a different level. Well, we get locked into it. I mean, a potential. For example, when I was sitting at the table the other day looking around at a group of college and post-college kids that, well, I'm pushing 35, but in some ways still see myself in that capacity, that I don't have to be at the same level of productivity that a person in a similar age capacity did 100 years ago, simply of economic necessity.
You mean you don't have to spend as many hours as they did?
Partly you don't have to spend as many hours, partly the level of affluence is such for a larger proportion of society that there's a period, instead of necessity becoming financially productive at age 16 to 18, we now have the freedom to put that off to age 22 to 24, which is about a 6-year time block that is a gain. You know, that's not an absolute statement, but I think it's a reasonable general statement.
I'm wondering, in my own head, it seems like not only is there a kind of retooling that's necessary in terms of one's mind to get off of what is the kind of competitive thing like you're talking about with your professors or like the thing that I'm in, the same, I think it's pretty much the same across the board. We live in a competitive kind of situation, whether we like it or not, so there's a retooling there. And then when you get through retooling, the insecurity of, all right, now that I've retooled, where do I go or what I'm going to do? So you've got two great big voids, it seems like, when you look at it. Or at least to me, that's what it looks like. Which would, I guess the point that I'm making is that it seems like this would prevent an awful lot of people from moving in alternative directions.
Of course, I think we're going to have to. I just don't think we can sustain the kind of productivity that we're engaged in for many centuries, for many decades. It may not be us, but we can't go on. And in a sense, the meaning of our existence wrapped up with productivity, we're going to have to find some other way. And this expenditure of things and packaged vacations. And for years, we spent our vacations in the dunes, a little piece of property, and nothing, not even a bathroom, with no expense, really. Absolutely minimum, and it's great, just great. The question is, how can you see that as meaningful? How can you institutionalize that? Those kinds of things. My son now is out there taking hundreds of feet of film of the dunes and the like. It evidently made some impression on him. It's very, it's real. Well, we have another meeting that's going to push us out, I think. I don't feel very finished with, I feel like we need to spend another hour just talking or so.
You know, Al, I think we can start doing these things if we really feel committed to take risks. And I think smelling risks, and I think we can, in maybe small community-like way, develop relationships with people in which we can do a lot of sharing. And I don't mean just sharing meals, but maybe there are a lot of other things we could share. And so maybe we could start consuming less and make it less necessary for productivity if we, you know, weren't the consumer that is always consuming. And I think, you know, like Paul last year said so much about the car, and if we could just have community laundries and things like that, and do a lot of the sharing, and I think our whole area of reality would be expanded, and we'd have better relationships with people, and more meaningful ones, and then maybe we could say, well, we don't really all have to work this hard either, because we're sharing.
Yeah, I have a kind of formula, but I know it isn't. You can't generalize. People have to take into account withdraw from consumption and withdraw from production. So you got time to think about what to do with your existence.
Yeah.
And withdraw from artificial vacations.
Yeah.
I mean, just you know. And think. I started paint last year, and I don't know why I started paint, but I just did. And it's a whole new thing. And I think I could paint 6 or 8 hours a day and enjoy it. And if I could just withdraw from a lot of other things. I'm not sure that's what I want to withdraw to, because I have a kind of a sense of responsibility for our common life. So it probably, I was thinking this morning about coming up here for a year or two, you know, get a plan so you could come up here and participate in a meaningful kind of productivity. It's productivity here. You're producing kind of lifestyle, experience of a lifestyle. It's productivity, but it's a meaningful productivity. And I don't know where you are all located and how ambiguous your productivity is.
I don't know if this is going to answer the first question you asked, but for me personally, there are times when I get very hyper about being here and thinking I'd better get back home because there are things that I've got to get together before I move to Chicago. And there are other times when I feel very peaceful here and think, gee, it would really be nice to stay until the snow flies. But I know that late in August I'm going to get out of here and go back because I start school in the fall. And I'd like to figure out a way to take the time off, but there just doesn't, my possibilities aren't quite that, I don't think. You know, it scares me a lot to think about taking a year off.
Yeah, you'll be a year older when you start to
yes,
when you start looking for a job, and
the farther into it you get, the worse it gets.
The more difficult to quit, right?
You get more trapped.
But it's not impossible.
Well, if I stay in school, I don't have to start paying my loans. That's
yeah.
That's one thing. That's a pretty good persuader.